couple statements last night.
One was a big positive, and that one was Easton Lucas making a statement that he's a big leaguer. Kid doesn't want to go down. Kid wants to stay pitching. He wants to hurl for the Toronto Blue Jays. Shut down the Boston Red Sox, one of the hottest offenses in all of baseball. Yeah, it was cold. I don't care. He was awesome. Again, Cole Hamels 2.0 is what he is, I guess. This is fine. But the other statement was less of a positive, I would say, because it really wasn't made by a Toronto team. It was made by their opponent, and that was the Florida Panthers. And the Florida Panthers last night, they decided to tell the Toronto Maple Leafs something that they probably deep down already knew, that the fans absolutely knew in their already guarded hearts, right? You're guarded. You thought nothing can hurt you. You're a Toronto Maple Leafs fan. You're not even thinking about letting... Well, actually, that's not true. You're definitely thinking about letting the hurt back in, or you're trying to do the move of, well, they'll probably lose in the playoffs because that's what they do, blah, blah, blah. You don't want to get your hopes up because you feel as though a team that has really provided you with very little postseason joy over your lifetime is going to all of a sudden start to do that. And I've never really understood the calculus on the whole getting ahead of it and doing the double death thing where you're like, oh, we're going to die. And then you do die and you're like, oh, well, I was right. It's like, okay, congrats. It's never really been my MO, but I get it. It's a lot of fans. But the Florida Panthers really did put the seed of doubt, really stamped the seed of doubt in the Toronto Maple Leafs last night and their fan base when it comes to the belief that they would beat that team in the postseason. A very shorthanded Panthers team, a group that was missing Matthew Tkachuk, a group that was missing Sam Bennett, and yeah, Aaron Ekblad. Three pretty key players for a Florida Panthers team that really has had a disappointing regular season. Like, there's no doubt about it. By their standards and who they are and the talent they have, they haven't been great this year. Yes, they've had injuries. Yes, there have been tough schedule stuff. Yes, they're coming off of a cup run and all those different things that allow you to kind of make excuses for them. There's no question. But ultimately, yeah, they've blown late leads and they haven't looked dynamic night in, night out, especially the games that I've watched them. Other teams seem to match up a little bit better against them than the Toronto Maple Leafs. Maple Leafs don't. They are just a really tough matchup. Talked about this a little last night on Leafs Talk with Justin Bourne, but the Florida Panthers just play a style that the Toronto Maple Leafs are kind of trying to play. Hey, take away the middle of the ice, dump it in, get in on the forecheck, establish turnovers, and then try to create chances off those turnovers in the chaos. Let's be that team. It's not a bad formula. If you can do it the way that the Florida Panthers do it. And last night, they absolutely cratered the Toronto Maple Leafs. It was not close. The best period that the Toronto Maple Leafs had was the second period, and they still, I think, gave up 14 shots in that frame and were outshot in that frame. And yeah, some of you, if you looked at the box score, you thought, well, maybe this is kind of vintage Toronto Maple Leafs because the score was close, and don't they just allow opponents to out-shoot them? And I would say, yeah, that sort of to a degree. But the first period was a caving, and so was the third. And the score probably should have been a little bit more lopsided than what it ended up being, which was 3-1 on an empty net goal. But the most concerning part of last evening's game was the way that the top line looked. The Leafs, as much as they've changed their coach and they've changed their style and there are encouraging signs with the group, there's just no doubt. There are encouraging signs. The goaltending is better. Wohl let in a bad goal last night. It was really an awful one. Okay, yep, he let in the bad goal. There's no doubt he did. But ultimately, he was really good in that hockey game. And their goaltending is much better than it has been in years past. You feel really, really good about taking those two guys into the postseason, the feeling that one of them would be able to get hot. And yeah, I think it's going to be Stolarz in game one as of now. Like, the way that you're reading the tea leaves, it does look like him. But even if Stolar stumbles out of the gate and he doesn't have the playoff experience, and so maybe it ends up being a little too much for him. Okay, cool. You go to Joe Woll and you feel fantastic about it. You feel great about your goaltending. The blue line is unquestionably the best and most balanced that it has been in the Auston Matthews era, right? This is it. It's the best defensive group that they have. I think that the top six has the most talent that it's ever had. The bottom six obviously leaves a lot to be desired, but ultimately, overall, the Leafs are in a pretty good spot. But this Panthers team, just horrific matchup for them. But to me, again, the most troubling thing about last night is that despite all those things that I just mentioned, it's still a group that is built on the premise of their stars need to dominate. That's why those guys make that money. And have we spent too much time talking about their money over the course of their careers in Toronto? Yeah, probably. Has the flat cap just created it so that fans are rabid when it comes to every single dollar that those guys make? No doubt about it. But last night, the first line was out attempted 9-17 in the game. And head to head, Matthews against Alex Barkov, it was 4-13 in favor of the Florida Panthers. And yeah, I want to say it's just one game, and I get it. You want to, it's like a burn the tape game, as the football coaches say for the Maple Leafs, right? You're burning the tape. Although I don't know if they want to do that on this one, because there's probably a few things that they want to take away from it. And I'll talk about those with my next guest. But if you're trying to build some confidence that things are going to be different come playoff time with this team, it's really difficult to see it against that Panthers group, given what we have seen between the two sides when they have played one another. Yes, Toronto beat them in the last game, but again, it was another situation where Florida was coming off of a back-to-back and scratched their captain minutes before the game started, and Toronto eked out a win. And so if this thing's going to work, Auston Matthews, Mitch Marner, William Nylander, the three of those guys can't combine for one freaking shot, which is what they did last night. Yes, Mitch Marner hit a post. Yes, Auston Matthews' chance was dangerous. But ultimately, that's just not going to be a formula that translates to postseason success. Derek Lalonde is a former NHL coach with the Red Wings from 22-25. He's also with the Tampa Bay Lightning playoff series against the Toronto Maple Leafs. He joins me again now. Hey, Derek, great to have you back on, man.
No, I just listened to your last 5 minutes. You know me, need me. You had it nailed. But I will appease you and answer any questions you have. I loved that game last night. Yeah. I love the assignment. You guys, you watch the NHL, but I actually dove that. I treated it almost like a pre-scout for both teams when I was coaching in the league. And it was awesome, man. You can see why those two teams are good, and that's going to be one hell of a matchup. So that was exciting to watch.
Well, I've got to tell you right now, Derek, I'm really hoping that it's not a matchup, that it's not one hell of a matchup, that Toronto draws anybody else in the first round, and that whoever Florida plays can knock them out. Because my big observation from this is that out of all the teams that Toronto could play, Tampa, Ottawa, whatever, this is just the nightmare matchup for them, that Florida does the things that Toronto wants to do, but they just do it better. And I guess when you were watching it last night, you know, I almost wish you didn't agree with me when you heard, like, I wish you didn't say I nailed it, because yeah, it was tough for Toronto in that game. They came out, Florida, they dominated. I thought that they put their hands around Toronto's neck and they really never let go except for a few moments in the second period. And so I guess I'll start with this, which is just when you watch that game and you said you treat it like a pre-scout, what was most concerning to you about last night's loss for Toronto?
I wouldn't say concerning. I will say this. Last night was a whooping. And last night was a playoff-type whooping. This wasn't 100% playoff hockey, but the legs were going a little more. This was a statement for Florida. Obviously, they came off 5 straight losses, which you never want to lose. It's never acceptable to have runs like that, being a cup contender like they are. But they were a shell of their team. They literally had 7 or 8 go-to guys out. They still have 3 or 4, but to get those couple pieces back, you know, to be slotted correctly, this was two teams that are already playing the right way. They don't turn pucks over. They don't give up odd mans. This was one that, you know, if you had a playoff matchup with those, that'd be one game that No doubt Florida got the best of it, but for me, it just reconfirms for the Toronto Maple Leafs and the job Chief has done is this is what winning looks like, guys. And you know, you talked about burning that tape. No, he's going to use this. He goes, this is the stuff they've been preaching. Both teams work off a forecheck now. Both teams do not give up easy offense. And you saw that last night, but that was a night in which Florida kind of got their game more to where Toronto did. Now, with that said, you know, this was a little tune-up, but the matchups were there. You can see both coaches, and obviously Paul had the last change, but it was Matthews, Barkov, Tavares, Lundell, the Latin Domi line versus Rodriguez, Holmberg versus Nosek. Both coaches, they erred on rhythm more than chasing that matchup all night. Playoffs is a little bit different. You're going to see a little more of some gamesmanship, teams taking advantage of some icings or maybe a quick change. So I don't think you saw everything last night, which I don't think Toronto minds. But for me, I've loved what Toronto's done all year. We played them when I was the head coach of the Red Wings beginning of the year, and it was an uneventful game. We were trailing 2-1 going into the third. They gave us no easy offense, and they left that arena happy with a 2-1 win, and both teams probably had seven chances apiece. We played them at home. We whooped them at home one time, and that was just a really good game for us. But I like where they're at. It's just a unique matchup because they're both playing playoff hockey. I'm not concerned if I am Toronto. They're playing the right way. And it's just the unfortunate reality of having Tampa and Florida within your division. But if you're going to be there in the end, it's the reality of it.
Yeah, I think I agree with you in a lot of the way that Toronto is trying to play. And they've done a much better job this season than in years past at what you just said there, which is low event hockey, right? They don't want to give up their opportunities, and they feel like they're not going to take a ton either. But the ones that they get are going to be in the hands of some of their superstar players, that top six line, and that they're going to be able to capitalize on them. They're going to give up shots from the outside, but they trust their goaltenders, and they have reason to do so because those guys have been great from those low event areas all season long, right? Take away the middle of the ice. Don't give your opponent too much. Last night, though, they got one shot from their top three guys against that Florida team. And that part of it, I go, okay, you're going to do better than that. I'm guessing I didn't look into this. I probably should have before this interview, and I had ample time to because I knew this before going in. But, yeah, I can't imagine that there are any games. And if there are, it's maybe one or two where you've ever seen those three guys combine for one shot in a game, right? Nylander, Matthews, and Marner. That is just incredibly low. So that's obviously far worse than what they are as a collective. And that is important perspective from you as a coach who has to think about these things as an 82-game thing, right? It's not just a one-game sample size. Even when you're trying to break it down, I'm guessing that maybe you do the five-game thing that coaches do, which is like, okay, what are our five-game sets look like? But, God, it's just hard when you think about the matchup between these teams in terms of the way they want to play and what you're talking about, and thinking that Toronto over seven is going to figure out a way to do what they want to do better than Florida, as both teams try to kind of employ a similar strategy. But with Florida just being so much deeper up front and better on the forecheck, that they kind of, like, they play the same style, but Florida just does it better.
I agree, but I will say this, and this is the fact that we're talking like this speaks volumes of where Toronto's at right now. Florida is a legit 1%er. They are the Stanley Cup champions, and they played like it. Even with their recent injuries, even with the guys out of the lineup, the underlying numbers will tell you that's a team ready to win another Stanley Cup. They're first in the league and giving up chances against, grade A chances, everything we talked about. They're already committed to playing on the forecheck and defending. They're going to get their special teams in order. But the fact that Toronto is knocking on that door, that wasn't the case 2 years ago, a year ago, 3 years ago with all those teams. And again, they've done one heck of a job from the coaching staff to the manager. We talked about that D-core being deep. I like the pairs. You get McCabe back. this team has a fighting chance. I don't think it's as insurmountable as you say, but when you're going to talk these top three, four, five teams, that's the matchup. And the fact that Toronto has put themselves in that position, I've been that team with Tampa. When you're legitimately one of the four or five teams, and what is the formula to get over that hump? And these two teams have done it all year, and they're trying to do it. So they're not as far as you think. The one matchup that does scare me is Toronto's D can get forechecked, and that's the big matchup difference in the two. And I think some underlying numbers play that out. But that changes again. This was a playoff feel last night, but this was still an 80%er. I still think Toronto has more, but I think Florida took a little more pride in that game last night because of the recent losing streak they've been on and having their kind of shell of their team back. So you're right. You've pinpointed everything, but this would be a fascinating matchup for me. Even two different penalty kills, special teams are huge. Toronto still does the, I wouldn't call it old school, but the more top-down pressure on the penalty kill, where the Florida is a diamond look. Even in the offensive zone, they're a huge possession team in Florida, but they work everything off the strong post when they reset. Toronto works stuff off the back post. It's just fascinating what this matchup is going to be. You talked about it being whooping last night. And again, I think Coach Berube is going to use this as, hey, I've told you all year, this is what it looks like. This is what a Stanley Cup champion looks like, and we need to get more. But the one concerning thing for me, and what you start watching in playoffs, is easy offense with zone time. And I know you hit all those numbers, the exacts. I don't know the exacts, but I left that game knowing they probably outchanced them 2-1. Grade A's were probably 2-1. But the one thing, and what Florida's going to be excited about, zone time, was 2-1. And playoff games, playoff hockey, the first thing a head coach goes to is he looks great at chances for, chances against, and he looks at zone time, because those are playoff keys. And again, both teams know it. Both teams have positioned themselves that way. And that's why it was a fun game to watch last night. And those are two legit heavyweight, one of four or five teams in the NHL. And again, you're concerned. You got to talk about it every day. I understand your media market, but the fact that we're talking about Toronto like this is a credit to that coach and that general manager. They're going to be a fun team to watch in the playoffs.
Yeah, listen, I'm with you in that regard. I feel more confident about this Leafs group than I have in the past. And there have been other years with them where I've gone, okay, like I really like this team, but not to the degree that I have liked this group in terms of what they try to accomplish as a group and what they actually have that I think is sustainable come playoff time. Again, it's to me, it's just more so about this matchup. I do feel better about Toronto versus Tampa this year. And you've seen that the regular season where they've beaten them three times, and we'll see what ends up happening tonight. Yep. I know that they haven't had as much success against Ottawa, but even still, that is an inexperienced group that's coming into the postseason. And my expectation would be that Toronto beats them and that they should beat them. It's just that, yeah, you're right. This is the Stanley Cup champion, but that's the standard for what this team is trying to do. Like, they're trying to become Stanley Cup champions. And this particular team is just really good. Really, really, really good. When they knuckle down, they have it. They have got just about everything that you would want to see from a team. So you mentioned that Berube's not going to burn the tape. He's going to use this. If you're taking it and you're trying to show this to your team, you know, you're sitting down for film study, what's the one thing from this that you want to drill down on?
For me, when you're talking about how, first of all, you're going to reemphasize what exactly Toronto has done this year. They don't give up easy offense. The numbers, they sacrifice offense for playing the right way, but that's what winning looks like in the postseason. So he's going to reemphasize that. To me, the one area they're going to need to lock down come playoff time is they need to get the puck out of their zone. And it's one area, and I give this team a little credit, that the Torontos of the past, Sheldon Keefe did one hell of a job with that group. I know we talked about it. I always appreciated Sheldon's team, but The errors are a lot the old Toronto teams would err a lot on puck possession, and you could stay on top of them on the forecheck. And if you think that through and you look back at Toronto in the playoffs sometimes, there was some times that they might have overhandled that puck, and that puck ends up in the back of their net off an opposing team's forecheck. So for me, it's one area Toronto is going to continue to work on. I know the game-winning goal came off a little OCP track, a little ozone, but that was a behind-the-net defensive turnover, and I like the play that D made. He had the shoulder check that he was going to get that puck up the wall, and they could have had an easy exit. But I still continue to emphasize the winning hockey, but I'm hammering and getting out of our zone because that's playoff hockey, and especially a matchup like they're going to face against Florida potentially. That's an elite forecheck team, and they love forechecking, and they're really good at it.
So you often hear players talk about during this time of year, we're just tidying up the little things down the stretch. And
yes.
So for you, it sounds like one of those things is going to try to just continue to be zone exits and ensuring that the puck Correct. Does get out. But yeah, what does that look like from a coaching staff this time of year? Because you obviously have to, you can't overreact to a game like last night. You're probably not going fire and brimstone. It's too late in the year. You are very close to the Stanley Cup playoffs, and you've got another big game tonight against Tampa that's of critical import to the standings. But what does tidying up the little things look like during a stretch run for this team and, for some of your teams in the past?
You get very little practice time down the stretch. You have to learn off video, but you do get some reps. And I know if my teams, whatever reps we had, it would be a lot on breaking down your breakout habits versus pressure. Just like anything, you're building it. You isolate those kind of habits. You isolate it breakouts off of forecheck, breakouts off first touch, breakouts out of D-zone, puck support. The things you see in practice all the time, and that'll be his point of emphasis. And again, it has all year. They're playing winning hockey. They manage their game extremely well. It's been a fun team to watch. They're trying to take those extra 2%. So that's what it looked like. I guarantee the film today, there'll be a little pre-scout on the Tampa Bay Lightning, but I think it's going to be a lot about the Toronto Maple Leafs and what we're trying to accomplish moving forward. And that'll be the meeting, and then their next practice, those are the types of reps they'll have. So you're lucky enough to go see that practice in Toronto. I could probably walk you through exactly what it would look like.
So again, you've prepped for these guys in meaningful games, not just with the Red Wings, but also with Tampa, right? You know, you're with a group that wins in 20 and 21. So when you're watching this team and you're prepping for them this year versus some of the years in the past, how materially different is it to you?
A lot. And again, they have been always a really good team and very well coached over the last two staffs. But this team is, they're not going to beat themselves. And that's why they have a chance. They're not going to beat themselves with lack of depth throughout their lineup. They're not going to beat themselves with style of play. There's times if you could play a patient game against Toronto, you stay committed to proper puck play, working off a forecheck, staying on top of it, you would get your chance. Probably off the forecheck, probably similar to the game-winning goal you saw last night. But again, this is a group that is committed to playing the right way. I call it winning hockey. I mean, you can break that down in many areas, but you don't see egregious turnovers. You see proper line changes. You see energy throughout the lineup. I watched the NHL, but last night I watched both those teams extremely close. And they're right there. And I don't say that lightly. I think that's a compliment to Toronto. They've always been a contender. They've been a top third team in the league for, a decade now. But this does feel different, and that's why it's exciting.
Yeah, they're on the longest postseason stretch they've ever been on. They're one of the biggest and best in North America in terms of that stat. It doesn't carry as much meaning in this market simply because of the lack of success in that area. But you're right. Like it has felt like they've been building something. they should certainly be getting credit for the strides that they've made it as a team defensively this season, because I think that that has been apparent. And they did have good defensive seasons under Sheldon Keefe, but yeah, there hasn't been quite this. And there also hasn't been the same goaltending, and there hasn't been the same depth of talent on the blue line as they've had in years past. So you give this group a little bit more of a nod in that direction as well. But yeah, you're right. There have been positive strides, but yeah, what you're looking for, I think, in a game like that still is, hey, where can you make the improvements? And one of the things that you said is they've got some depth throughout the lineup. The problem that a lot of people see with this team, myself included, is that while they have depth when it comes to some talent, the bottom six has never really coalesced for this team. And you think about Florida and one of the challenges that they have against that team, and one of the things that you really felt in last night's game, right, is when they're on the forecheck, it's not just one line that comes over, plays that way, and establishes that style. It's wave after wave after wave. And that's how you end up in a situation like you do last night, where they get that many offensive zone opportunities. They force those that many turnovers because their forecheck is relentless group to group to group, and they really do have synergy between those two, or those four lines. With Toronto, you know, you take away a game last night from the top line where they end up with no, like, again, one shot for Austin Matthews, no shots for Mitch Marner. You get a second line that ends up having William Nylander get no shots on net, and you're going to feel pretty damn good about your chances. Again, I don't think that's the norm. I don't think that that's easy to do, but the bottom six has not really coalesced for this team. They made a big ad in Scott Laughton at the deadline. And I'm curious, from your standpoint as a coach, how long, when you would be putting a line together, right, especially a depth line, not a top line with a bunch of talent, how long before you started to feel like, okay, we either have something or we don't with this group of players, and we're going to kind of know it moving forward?
Yeah, that can happen overnight. And again, I like how Toronto's slotting. I don't know Camp. I don't know enough when he's coming back. But I think that bottom six looks a lot different when he comes in the lineup. I think he wins draws. I like his energy. His pop was the one time we played him in Tampa in the playoffs, and he had an impact on the series. So I think it looks a little bit different. That could happen overnight. I remember when in Tampa, for us to finally get over the hump to be that Stanley Cup champion-winning team, yes, everything you talked about, we had to learn and change our DNA. Everything that you see in Toronto last night, everything you see in Florida last night, we had to learn that, and that took some growth. But the line that really carried us was the Yanni Gord, Barkley, Gaudreau, Blake Coleman line. And if you recall, we probably got a little bit lucky that year in the fact that we acquired Gaudreau and Coleman at the deadline, and we didn't have a fit for them. You know, we had those guys sprinkled in our bottom six, on the wing in the top six, and it was just okay. But then we had the pause for COVID, and then I wouldn't say we backed into it, but we put those three together, and it was just a chemistry that literally led us to our two Stanley Cups. So I like what they're trying to do. I love the Laughton pickup. I like that line at times. Again, it feels like almost a hybrid center look with Laughton and Domi, you know, who's first down low is going to be the center look. They can be interchangeable. I think those guys are extremely valuable come playoff time, especially in a bottom six. I'm not as concerned about that bottom six. I think it will perform when the time comes. And again, if you get Camp in there, I think it's a completely different look, especially on the road where you just – it's a little easier to get exposed, especially with the matchups. But, you know, you talked about an off night last night. This is a mature team. In the playoffs, you need four. And I look at last night, if I'm on that staff and that's a playoff game, I tip my hat to Florida. That's their one. They beat us last night, and now we're going to go get ours. So, again, that's why I think the matchup is fascinating. And again, I know Toronto competed against them twice this year. I've admired what they've done all year. But then when you really look into them, are they really a contender? Are they deep enough? The holes we talked about. And I like where they're at. I think they are. So I get the concerns from last night. It's a regular season game. It is real. You don't just turn on in the playoffs, but I think this team is really well equipped, and they've given themselves a really good chance.
Even still, though, when you are playing them, and I'm sure you did with Tampa specifically, especially like playoff time, the feeling wasn't, hey, if we can slow down this top line, we really like our chances?
Of course you got to check them. That's anything. Yeah. Like, those are elite superstar difference makers, of course. And, of course, that's a reality of, but that can look different in many ways. You could go power on power. We had the luxury of those teams back in the day. We had a true checking line where it would free up Cooch and Pointer and the boys against a different type of matchup. The one thing, and you talk about the matchup, Barkov, he's a unicorn, man. He's a cheat code. He's special. He's built for playoffs. He's a matchup nightmare for anyone. And that's going to be that's the reality. That's where it's at. I know Chief might get away from that when he gets home ice, the last matchup against them. What does that look like in the middle of the playoffs? I don't know. Yes, of course, you got to check that. But that's why they're Stanley Cup champions. And I give a tip of the hat to Lundell. I don't think he gets enough credit for his two-way play. He's a guy you win with. He's a guy that wins shifts. He's a guy that has unbelievable two-way game. This is why they won a Stanley Cup last year, and they're going to be knocking on the door again. But Toronto is equipped to give this a legit chance.
Yeah, Barkov, Lundell going 1-2 that way from a defensive standpoint. You're right. I like the word cheat code. And last season, you know, that cup run was so special for Barkov. Like, he was such a treat to watch. And I'm texting with people going, this is literally the experience of what it was like watching Kopitar in his prime win those Stanley Cups, except for this guy. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. Kopitar, if you look at his playoff runs, they were absolutely insane. And I watched Barkov, yeah. And I went, hey, God, is this guy better? Like, is this guy a better version of what I already thought was at the very tippity top versions of this kind of players? But yeah, I just like, again, last night he outplayed Matthews to the tune of 4-13 for Barkov when they went head to head. And like, can you explain, is there a way to explain what he means as a cheat code and why he is such a difficult player to match up with?
Yeah, he's a coach's dream in reality. And we all want offense. And he produces enough offense. But his hockey IQ and his ability to game manage he's a one percenter. He's a Hall of Famer. Probably, you know, we talked about L.A. and those cup runs and what Kopitar is. To have that size, to have that hockey IQ, and to have the DNA to play winning hockey. Everything we talked about from the outset, what does it look like? You don't give up easy offense. You win your shifts. You gain lines. You're physical when it needs to be. You eat a puck when it needs to be. You win that important faceoff when you need to be. That's his DNA. Now you add the fact that he can make plays offensively. He can win the ground game and the fact that he loves possession time in the O zone. He is a special freak, if you will, of a player. I'm glad he got rewarded with his Stanley Cup, because the way you and I are talking about him is the respect he gets in NHL locker rooms. It's the respect he gets in the NHL circles. I don't know if he got as much of that from the average fan or the rest of the 98% of the hockey world, but he is that guy, man. He's that dude. He's a special, and again, not an accident why they are where they're at and why they're knocking on the door again, and he drives it.
So it's another big game tonight. I would actually say that for Toronto, this is the bigger one because they're trying to win the Atlantic. They want to be able to, have home ice, of course, but I think also just, God, I made this point about them before, but mentally, just to be able to say, hey, you won something. You accomplished this as a group. You went into the season. You finished first in the Atlantic. You did it down the stretch run. Great. You removed yourself from the automatic playing another Atlantic opponent, which they've had year over year over year, and it's been such a grind for them in the first round. And not like anybody is an easy matchup, but God, like we talked about it, if Florida does end up in that number three spot, you certainly would like to avoid them. You would like to have a year where you're not playing Boston or Tampa, right, in the first round. So you've got this big game tonight.
It's real.
Yeah, of course. Of course it's real.
It's not the end be all. And again, coaches, you don't think like that. I guarantee that's not going to be brought up in the room tonight. It's going to be about their process. But it's that those matchups, that's a reality. I see the frustration at times with some fans with the 2-3 and some of these first round matchups you're going to see. You know, some of the traditionalists would love that 1-8 matchup, but it's a reality of it. But there's some reality to that. Like, sometimes it's who you play and when you play. And again, I do think home ice, just the exact same things we talked about, having that last change, being able to control those matchups. Again, most coaches, it's not the end be all. I think a lot of the modern coaches today, they chase matchups because it's the reality of it. You get such insight through analytics and how to move that needle a little bit, but most coaches still do kind of err on just rhythm of the team. But we just talked about it. I would love to avoid Barkov as much as possible with a last change. So those things are real, but again, Toronto's a loss. They're still in a really good process. And it's going to be process-oriented tonight. It'll be interesting to see how this does play out. But this end of the year, this posturing, if you will, this gamesmanship, it's real. And you saw how real it was for Florida last night. You can see the intensity in that group. I liked even the skirmish at the end. That was not an accident. This is becoming ramped up in a good way. And again, this division is an absolute bear. It's going to be really fun to watch come playoff time.
I don't think that you as a group would ever be like, oh my God, we got to avoid this team. We got to avoid this team. And that you're talking about it as players and coaches, right? You're not going into the playoffs and setting yourself up that way. But in quiet moments, like you said, it's real. It's definitely got to be in the back of your head when you're looking at, like, you're checking the standings, right? You're taking a peek and saying, okay, how's this looking? How's this shaping up?
Real for sure. And again, that's not something you talk about in the room, but Craig's in the elbow room with a little downtime and the coaches are just chatting. One of the young video coaches might bring up, boy, it'd be nice to avoid this matchup or this because of that. That's a reality of it. But again, it's process oriented. I know it sounds like a cliche, but that's real. And we're patting Toronto on the back because of the way they're playing, the way they're looking. They've bought into this process from day one. And it's a credit to them. And again, I know we have to talk about it. You have to talk about it. I know it's very passionate fan base. Every game has its highs and lows. They put a lot into it. But the fact that we're talking about Toronto like this is a good thing. I look at it from a coach's standpoint. I look getting the most out of each team. And I just, again, really like the DNA of that group. And again, you put Camp back in there, you put McKay back in there. I know the goaltending has been great, but when you get goaltending like that and that consistent, that's a team stat. They're a good team to play with right now.
So the team they played tonight, Tampa, obviously there is still connective tissue from the teams that you were a part of, right? And all those guys still being at the top, like, you know, the Braden Points, the Victor Hedmans, you've still got that. The Nikita Kucherovs, like, that's all, the Vasilevsky, that's still there. So your core, to a degree, minus Stamkos, remains intact. But so much turnover from the teams that you were a part of, right? Like, basically the rest of the team. And even though they're bringing back Yanni Gourde, you know, he's still left for a little while. What is it about this group? Yeah, what is it about this group that impresses you the most this season? Because when you mentioned the, like, Barkov going under the radar stuff, I feel as though Tampa, probably more than any other really good team this season, has gone under the radar.
I think they know what winning looks like. And I know it sounds simple, but everyone wants people to have won Stanley Cups. And people make such a big thing about it. And it's not them winning the Stanley Cup. It was the process of winning the Stanley Cup. And some of those guys that you mentioned, they transformed their game to winning hockey. Kucherov, points. I talk about Ryan McDonough all the time. Ryan McDonough, he literally eats, sleeps, and drinks and just dreams about not letting the other team score. And you just need guys like that. And I think Julian Brisebois is the best manager in the league. The fact that he kept that core together, the fact he got Ryan McDonough back, the fact he got Yanni Gord back. There's just certain pieces that you end up winning with, and those are winning hockey guys. So everything we talked about in what winning looks like, and again, we're becoming repetitive here, but you watch the Stanley Cup the last 10 years, and whoever last two teams standing, it's the same type of hockey. You're working off a forecheck. You're getting above. There's certain parts of the game that are important. You talk about owning the middle of the ice, things like that, not beating yourself. It all looks the same. And Tampa is a team with that DNA. They've been there. They've seen it. And when you start getting that from your top-end skill, I remember Nikita Kucherov just learning how to manage the puck. Like, and it drove him nuts. He wants puck possession. He wants the puck the whole time. And he gives you the Kucherov glare if you give the puck up. But at the same time, you would see him chipping pucks into soft areas, working off forechecks, him working above. He's the guy breaking up plays in the crease on a 5-versus-6 play. I just think there's a DNA there. That's a hungry team. They know what it looks like. They've just done a really good job of working around that core that you talked about and filling in the pieces. And again, we talked about cheat codes. You always have a chance with Andre Vasilevsky, and I think they know that.
So tonight then, this again, it's weighty from the standings, and you mentioned it already in terms of the import of trying to hunt that home ice advantage and it being there in the back of your mind from a coaching staff perspective and thinking about, yeah, who you'd match up with in the postseason and go on down the line. But this does feel more important for Toronto tonight, just given Tampa's already had that team success. Tampa, I would guess, has a different level of confidence finishing this season in second rather than finishing in first if you are Toronto. Toronto coming off of this loss against Florida where, yeah, it's a disheartening one, where it's just not a good one, where, like, we both described it as a whooping. How much are you going to read into a matchup like this then? Because, yeah, obviously everything ends up happening in the playoffs, but if you get, you know, the doors blown off you two straight nights to your two biggest competitors, I have to think it means something to the staff.
I think it's human nature for good teams, quality teams, and we've established Toronto is a quality team with good DNA. You come off a loss, and your urgency does amp up a little. That's why you don't see these good teams go on long runs. That's why you see these good teams bounce back after losses. You saw it in Florida, 5 straight losses. Unacceptable. I get it. They had an awful lineup with their show, their team. But you saw their 8 urgency go up a notch. I think you'll see that from Toronto too. You'll see it from Tampa. Again, the league will be pumping a little bit more. There will be a little more edge. There'll be a little more to the winning hockey as this team starts to get their game in order for the playoffs. So again, I don't put too much stock. I think you would see that from a Toronto team back in December coming off a loss, where their urgency goes up. But of course, this is a potential matchup. This is a little bit of a measuring stick. And again, this is not the end be all, and I don't say that negatively, but 100% is real. These games take a little more meaning to it, and why it was fun to watch. And again, I sound like a fan when I first came on. I enjoyed watching that game last night. It's competitive. It's a juice. It's why our sport is what it is. But it was fascinating to see that matchup, and you know, tonight will not be much different.
Well, yeah, just over the course of 82 games, even as a coach who is, you know, wanting every single one of them, yeah, it's going to feel a little different when you see the amping up, right? Like, they're the ramping up of competition and getting closer to the postseason and seeing teams kind of really show the fine-tuning. Derek Lalonde, again, former NHL head coach, thank you so much for the time today, man. I really appreciate it getting to pick your brain.
Loved it, and thank you. You got me starting to think playoffs here, getting juiced up about things. It's going to be really fun again.
100%. We'll be talking to you during the postseason. Thanks, Derek. There he goes, Derek Lalonde, former head coach of the Red Wings, and yes, with the Tampa Bay Lightning as an assistant from 18 to 22. So it's pretty clear tonight means a lot. It means a lot in terms of not just avoiding Florida, which is, I think, the way that I've pretty much framed this. They're like, yeah, you can't face the Panthers. You can't face the Panthers. But it's true. And Derek's right in a lot of ways, talking about this Leafs team. They have matured in a lot of areas. There are the reasons that we have gone over and over and over again about why you feel more confident about them as a group. I don't agree with him about the third line. I think that, yeah, he is looking at it through a coach's lens. The guy knows more about hockey than I ever will pretend to know. But that depth, that ability, and Tampa's going to be able to have it tonight too, to just roll those top three lines and feel like they're all threatening and that they all have an identity, is just something that Toronto is, I don't think, going to have. Maybe those other players, maybe Max Domi and Scott Laughton are a terror, and it's the Barkley Goudreau thing of years past, and we all look stupid for having doubted them, right? Maybe. I can't rule it out entirely. But last night was still a bit of a reminder of, hey, if you can wipe out those top guys, and who can't you say that for, right? Like, of course, you take away any team's top line, and it's going to be harder for them to have success, but it's already a tight rope that this team wants to walk when it comes to the low event hockey stuff, the scoring chances that they're going to generate. And no, they don't routinely have one shot from their first line or from their best two players on the first line, blah, blah, blah. Got to show something tonight. This is actually a must win. This, as regular season games go, we always say, oh, well, this is a must win. I'm joking with Ennis yesterday about the Blue Jays season must win. You got to win tonight. You have to find a way to beat this Tampa Bay Lightning team. And yes, it's a back-to-back, and you played Florida. Who cares? You got to win. You got to find a way to beat Tampa and get yourselves in that position where you're, A, finishing first in the Atlantic so that you can't – you don't want to go crazy with the matchup hunting stuff. I do think that we spend a little bit too much time at times oversimplifying and going, well, this is it. This is the matchup. But it's like, yeah, you saw it last night with them just being able to staple Barkov to Matthews, and the Leafs have been welcoming of that all year long in terms of – best on best, but my God, you see numbers like that and you go, yeah, it'd be great to avoid it. Be great to avoid the potential of that and be able to control it if you need to, but can't lose to Tampa tonight. Can't open the door for what has been such a good regular season to devolve into two huge losses and scoreboard watching against tough teams down the stretch to hope that you avoid that 2-3 matchup. Anyways, you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple or on Spotify. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. Reach out anytime with your thoughts. Going to take a quick break, and I want to talk about some of the things that actually made me happy last night, which was, yeah, the Toronto Blue Jays.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
10 and a third. Four hits. Three walks, 11 Ks, and no runs surrendered. That's Easton Lucas. That's Easton Lucas baseball. You hand that guy the ball, and he is going to hurl. Incredible stuff. Truly. So there's a bunch of things to be excited about the start of this Blue Jays season, right? And usually these things do tend to come back down to earth, right? Do you feel like Andreas Giménez is going to hit a million home runs? Like, he was red hot, scorching hot to start the season. And now what's your confidence when he comes to the plate look like? Just being honest, do you feel like, oh boy, now you've done it when there's base runners on, like he's going to go opposite field, put it over the fence? No, he's Andreas Giménez and you feel good. And he's had a nice start, but some of this stuff, like I said, just normalizes a bit. Do you feel like Vladdy and Bo and Santander are going to hit no home runs? Santander, another night where I was like, please do something, do a thing. I know it's cold and you don't like the cold, but come on, man. But Easton Lucas has to be the most fun story of the season so far for the Blue Jays. Like, I don't even know. I don't even know what would be close. Like Heinemann, I guess, raking. It's like Heinemann, just every time he steps into the batter's box, all of a sudden being a guy. This is like a tough out. Drew a walk and had two hits last night. Great stuff from Tyler Heinemann. But yeah, Easton Lucas is by far the most entertaining story to me. And now I just can't wait to see where this thing keeps going. It's been thrilling. Both starts, I thought that he was going to get shelled. No question. And I thought last night against the Red Sox, it was going to be the same thing. I went like Garrett Crochet versus Easton Lucas. Boy, they threw him out there for two starts that were supposed to just be losses. And he grabbed them both as wins. And that, God, that's so fun when you feel like you don't have a chance and then you come through and you win. But not just he like got lucky. This wasn't some BABIP miracle for Easton Lucas. He was awesome. He pitched great and he looks confident. And we'll see what that looks like when he finally surrenders a run, if he ever surrenders a run. But God, what a fun story this has been from the kid. And I'll tell you this too. It continues to be really encouraging for this baseball team. I don't think the power is going to come, and I don't think that it's just because it was cold in Boston last night that they're not hitting home runs. But the early signs of George Springer, again, just George Springer doing his thing, hit a bomb, couple of hits, worked a walk. Whew, making it tough not to believe. But the stuff of just down the lineup, the lack of power, but sure, but guys who can hit singles and guys that you're asking to draw walks, and no, Miles Straw is not supposed to be in the lineup every single night. Neither is Tyler Heinemann. But those players giving you competitive at-bats and getting on base and setting the table for the Bo Bichettes and Bo with three ribbies last night because of those guys and the Vladdies is of critical import. And so it's like depth to the roster in terms of the bats and depth with the pitching. Those both showed up again last night for this team and got them a win. And you got to be happy about that. You got to take that, even though it's early in the season, who cares? The wins all count the same, and they're doing it in a fashion that none of us really expected. So great win for the Blue Jays last night. Anyways, it's the most important golf time of the year. It's the Masters. I've got a preview for you next with Shane Ryan. So I did mention this yesterday. And part of it is that I'm not a golf diehard. I don't watch every single tournament. It's been March Madness. It's been an incredibly important stretch run for the local hockey team. Blue Jays have started hot. It's a busy time of year. But yeah, Masters is like the hype surrounding getting ready for this one has been a little bit more muted for me in years past. And a lot of that is probably like it's not that complicated. It's just like Tiger Woods. So when you don't have Tiger Woods around, it's like, yeah, you're not getting as many casuals talking about the guy that every single casual wants to talk about, including, actually, I shouldn't even say the casuals because it's like the diehards who love Tiger so, so very much. But yeah, removing that massive narrative piece is a huge thing. But yesterday, I read our next guest's piece previewing this tournament and who could win. Your vibes only guide on Golf Digest right now. It made me laugh many, many, many times reading it, and it made me very excited for the Masters, which I always am, but God, it was great. It's Shane Ryan, contributor for Golf Digest and author of The Cup They Couldn't Lose. Good morning, buddy. How are we doing?
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Your piece was great. It starts really hot with the Rory stuff. It's immediately. The bad vibes of not throwing it into the water. I was like, yeah, you're right, not destroying the phone. Okay, so there's a lot to dive into, and I do want to get into some of the stuff from the piece, but I got to start with this. A bunch of trees fell down at Augusta, and I don't think that everybody is aware of this. I know the golf hardcores are aware of this, but yeah, Hurricane Helene did damage to this course. There's a bunch of trees that fell, and I've heard that specifically hole 16 took a ton of damage. How do the rich people make the course look like we need it to look?
Yeah, I mean, they're dressing people up like pine trees and stacking them up on top of each other. It's really...
Yeah.
That does feel like an Augusta thing that they would do, right?
It's like just well, it's like they get rid of the squirrels. Like, everybody always talks about how they have these weird grounds crew things where it's not a real place on Earth. And now it feels like a real place on Earth because a hurricane happened and it was not untouched. Things actually got happened. But yeah, you can't easily replace the kind of trees they have. And I've seen a couple of quotes from some of the golfers talking about, like, oh, there's different looks at some of the holes, But so much of this tournament is that it's like nothing changes here. This is Neverland. And yet I'm curious to see if it's like noticeable on the broadcast or if we can pick it up as fans or whether it actually impacts this tournament at all.
Yeah, I think it's going to. You're right. I mean, these are towering pine trees. They don't grow in a month. I did a story on the town of Augusta for Digest after this hurricane hit, and it was devastating. I mean, I'm in North Carolina, and, you know, it was probably a little bit worse where we were in western North Carolina and Asheville. I live in the east, so. But, yeah, it was awful in Augusta. I mean, it destroyed – not only did it destroy a ton of houses, but these trees are – you know, once pine trees get so big and tall, a stiff wind can knock them over. So when this came through, I mean, it really, really devastated. So, you know, I think even on TV, you're going to notice a big difference. And Augusta, of course, has more money than anybody else in that area. They can recover a lot faster. Mm-hmm. But you can't replace a pine tree that's 50 years old and I don't know, 300 feet high. So, yeah, it's going to be very, very different. You know, how it affects things, I think maybe the biggest thing you'll say is that some balls that may have been dead in the woods before might not be anymore. In terms of 16, there may be different paths. I don't think you're going to see many people taking different paths because, you know, ultimately the trees are on the sides anyway. But there may be little things like that on 16 where all of a sudden it's like, oh, interesting. This was impossible before, and now we can do a little something different.
I got to tell you, I'm a little disappointed, though, that they didn't just find a way to replace age-old pine trees. exactly. Like, this is kind of hopeful for the future of just knowing, hey, when things happen, what did they do at Augusta to replace? That's what they did? Okay, so it just takes money? Sometimes you want to believe that money can fix just everything, right? It's like when a billionaire dies of cancer, I'm like, oh, no. Same feeling.
Yeah, I know. I wanted to do that too. Like, there's a town in Finland right now that has no more trees because they had them all sent over.
I would have been okay with that. So as you were coming on, I was mentioning how it's felt a little muted to me coming into the Masters this week, and it always ramps up. Like, it's never, unless it was like Tiger's return, where he just feels like, oh, okay, next week. So I don't want to overstate the feeling of this, but I think part of it for me has been the narratives around the tournament feel even more familiar than they ever have before, where it's like, okay, Scottie Scheffler, right? Even though it feels as though the majority of people have already kind of made up their minds about him. And I'm not sure that him winning it 3 out of 4 times even changes. Like, it's like, he's already won it 2 out of the last 3 times. What else do you kind of want from this guy? Rory at Augusta, we do this every year, and so it's kind of reaching a point where when he's one of the top storylines, you're like, yeah, but also call me Sunday. Well, actually, call me Thursday, because if he doesn't put himself out of contention day one like he loves to do, then great. Then we'll get more excited for the Rory story. And then lastly, the weird live stuff that's hanging over things, which is, oh, okay, well, the negotiations are once again kind of contentious and exhausting between these groups, and there's buzz about certain guys that weren't happy about their decisions or blah, blah, blah. And Liv just had their most successful tournament ever in terms of a viewership standpoint, but it was still like 400,000 people. Like, nobody watched still, and it's their best one. But now we don't even have the juice that we had with Liv before, right? Where it was like, oh, us versus you, because Liv is kind of dead and it didn't really work out. And guys are trying to kind of figure a way to get back and be like, yeah, sorry. Are bad that we tried to do this thing, and no one feels like there's rivalries there, especially after like Rory McIlroy backed off of it and was like, no, it's just guys trying to get their money. And you're like, oh, okay. So we can't believe in the hate between these guys. So yeah, I don't know. Are you kind of feeling the same way about this Masters, or is this just like a casual's outlook on it?
No, I think first of all, it's good for me to hear the casual outlook, because that Digest for like, all right, this is where all our traffic comes from. So everybody all in. Yeah. So the Masters is the biggest thing in our minds, right? So it's sometimes hard to put myself out. But I do think, yes, even talking with my friends, I think that's a great point. Now, people are going to watch the Masters because it's the Masters, and that's, you know, it's the most exciting tournament of the year. But to your point, is the Liv thing is exhausting now. There was something so interesting about the first time after they split up. Oh, man, the Liv guys are coming back. This is the first time they're going to play together. Maybe a year later, you still had some of that juice. There's none of that juice now, largely because the two things you mentioned. One, it's exhausting to keep hearing about the negotiations. I mean, the rumors you kept hearing at the end of last year were, oh, it's imminent, you know, by the players, they're going to have a deal. Now it's very clear that there's some serious things that can't work through So the deal does not seem close. And also, just the fact that LIV is kind of just a failed golf league. So it's not fun anymore. It's not like, oh, what a great rivalry there. You know, this is going to be, here come the two juggernauts. No, like the PGA Tour is doing a little bit better this year. Like you said, LIV just underwhelmed in what was their best, you know, their best ratings thing ever. So it's kind of like, oh, this is exhausting. It seems like players like Brooks Koepka kind of want to come back. So there's not any juice there. And, yeah, I just think, you know, I wrote this at the very start that when you have a schism in a sport, it's very bad for the sport if it doesn't get resolved quickly. I always go back to IndyCar, which people don't really remember, and I certainly didn't remember. I'm not old enough. How popular that was in the U.S. before it broke into whatever the two things were, like IRL and whatever. And now it's nothing. Like, look how, you know, how much more popular NASCAR or F1 is. It absolutely killed that sport. And, you know, golf's a little bit lucky that it doesn't have – there's not some more successful rival other than LIV in the PGA Tour. But still, it's not been good for it, and it's turned people off. And so I think you're going to see the knock-on effects everywhere, but, it's, you know, even at the Masters, which, you know, if there's any tournament that's scandal-proof or anything, it's Augusta. But just like you can't replace pine trees, you cannot turn off the bad feelings people have from what's happened in professional golf the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think that that's certainly a part of it, at least for me. And yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't really thought about it that way in the sense of usually it's always, hey, competition breeds a better product. Like it just is. It's the nature of things. Hey, you've got a competitor. You've got to be better. You've got to step your game up. But now for the PGA, the way that things have gone, they're like, no, this was actually perfect for us. We can just do it however we want. The competition was a complete failure. We're good. We're fine. Thanks, LIV. You gave a bunch of players a bunch of money, I guess, and you hurt some of the, I think, narratives that we have around certain players or the care, but that mostly just hurt those guys' individual brands more than it did the PGA.
Yeah, I think there's two things happening, and one is that the other is that they, you know, I think probably the investors that came in from FSG do want that Saudi money in, so there probably is the impetus for a deal, but on the other side, just like you said, I mean, this was a panic situation at the start that has gradually gone more and more in the PGA Tour's favor, where all of a sudden it's kind of like some war where you're getting attacked, and then all of a sudden you're like, wait, I think we're winning. I think the other side's running out of steam. And it does feel like that where, you know, somebody, I think I was listening to No Laying Up, and they made a terrific point where you think of this PIF of Saudi Arabia, their investment fund, as bottomless, but it's something like $1 trillion or a little bit less. They've spent $5 billion on LIV Golf for almost no return so far. And you think that that's, you know, what is that? Like 0.5? It's almost 1%, right? That's not nothing. You know, like how much are you going to throw at a golf league? These guys are not in the – even though they're rich beyond anybody's wildest dreams, they're not going to throw away 1% or 2% of their portfolio on a failed golf league forever. So there is that thing of like maybe it's, you know – who knows what they're thinking, but maybe it's not as bottomless as we thought. But the problem is, as you alluded to, when you get a sense that one side is winning, but the other side being PIF and the Saudi Arabia, they're not used to losing, and they don't like that either. It just kind of further entrenches both sides so that, you know, here we go, a few months from thinking a deal was imminent, now it seems like it's further than ever, which is tough. And, you know, to your point about schisms, there is that concept that, okay, competition breeds, everybody's going to step up their game. The problem is when you have players who aren't meeting on the same field, like, you know, it happened in boxing too, where, you know, you can go an entire, Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather don't fight until they're both old men, right? That's not good for anybody. People want to see the best fighting. Same thing happened in IndyCar. Same thing's happening in golf. So in that case, I think that rule of, oh, competition makes us better doesn't really apply here.
Well, I also think that you feel that a little bit when you're watching the events and you see some of these leaderboards, and there's a lot more unfamiliarity with the names, because there really was a point, you know, right before LIV, where a lot of leaderboards felt like you had a ton of guys that you know. And part of it is you just have to, you know, develop new guys and new names that people become aware of and players that you can become attached to, or like that's the sport. But recently, to me anyways, again, casual, it has felt like I'm like, wait, who's this? Who's that? Who's this? Like, I got to learn 8 new names on Sunday? Oh, all right, well, maybe I'll just not watch.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the larger problem in golf, is that the longer this goes on, the worse that gets. And you're right, though. There's new stars develop, but it's just a fact when you have fewer, you know, we have so many big names who went to LIV. You get PGA Tour, the signature events are wonderful, and you have great leaderboards, and you know everybody. But it's the in-between where you're looking at it. And, geez, you just can't get Scottie Scheffler and Rory out there every week. You know, Spieth is not going to play every week. And then in the past, when you had a few more names, you would say, okay, well, look, this tournament in Mexico or whatever, it's not great, but we do have Bryson playing. Or, you know what I mean? Somebody like that. Brooks Koepka is still there. Now it's not the case all the time. So I think it's really, I mean, even on the PGA Tour, it's the have and have not tournaments. And the haves are great. They're really, I think, really, they're excellent. And then, but the have-not tournaments are kind of like, oh boy, this is pretty dire sometimes on the leaderboards.
Yeah, and so much of this tournament specific is like, who's hot at the right time, right? Like, who's coming into this with some juice? And all the live players coming over, you have no idea. Like, it's like, okay, so they're doing what on live? All right, right on. I don't know. I guess Rom is doing great. He's sneakily great on live. News to me, but I'll buy him because I've also seen him in this event. But when it comes to the other guys, it's like, yeah, all right. We're kind of throwing darts here. Okay, so outside of these things, which I've just like crapped on golf, I'm like, oh, yeah, grumble. What is the most compelling story to you that does not involve Rory or Scotty?
Shoot, those are my two answers.
I think I'll get to them.
I get it. No, I think that this is kind of a cop-out a little bit, but I think what's great about the Masters is the compelling stories that are going to develop after Thursday. So just to throw a few out here, Ludwig Åberg, who is, I think, a really great young Swedish player. To me, this year feels like he's on the verge of a breakthrough. He's such a great talent, and I think he's going to win a major. So that would be a story to me where I'm very excited to see what he does. Then there's just a bunch of Americans that are kind of, I just think they're ready to explode. It's been a bad year for the Americans. We haven't won a lot. But you look at guys like Akshay Bhatia or Russell Henley, they're playing really, really well. And I think they're, you know, in their own ways, they're, you know, Akshay's young and interesting. Russell Henley's having this career renaissance late. These are guys who I follow more closely than, of course, the casual fan would. But I'm very excited to see how they do at Augusta because I think they're going to do really well. Storylines, I do think the live storyline is somewhat intriguing of, like, you had Phil Mickelson quote earlier this year that Joaquin Niemann is the best player in the world, which is just outrageous, but he is doing well on live, but the guy hasn't had a top 15 in a major in his whole career in 20 tries. So a guy like that, where you're like, oh yeah, you're lighting up live, but to your point, what does that mean? Let's see how you do it, Augusta. There's a storyline that's interesting to me. So there's a handful there, but you know, on Thursday by 2 p.m., we'll have a dozen more that are going to be so intriguing.
No, but I think that's actually a great answer because so much of what I'm talking about where it goes, hey, there's not a lot of juice, that always turns on its head the second Thursday happens, right? Someone gets out to a two-stroke lead and we're absolutely. Like, look at this, right? Like, we're so compelled. And then everyone is stuck and glued to the couch for the entire weekend and can't wait to see how it actually develops. And that comes from, I think, the prep of the diehards like you and people who we actually read is trying to find out more about these guys and getting more information about the dudes who start to emerge. And so, yeah, I am excited for that. And once it does happen Thursday, I'm going to forget all about all the things that I've kind of talked about and just be very, very enthralled by the tournament itself. Okay, so Rory, though. There is no bigger potential for this tournament always than Rory being there on Sunday, like actually being competitive. Obviously, the start for him matters, I think, more than anyone, considering what has happened in years past. And then, like, even what was the one year where Rory, like, finished with the top five? But it was all at the end. It was like, okay, great. No one cared. We were out on this from the very beginning. You don't seem at all. Well, I could say, I think in your piece you said he doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning this tournament. Stop doing that. Yeah. But he's been good, and he is, I guess, like, I think number two in the betting favorites. Are you just out on Rory because of the past? Like, where are you at with this?
Look, I was there at Pinehurst last year, okay? I see what happens when you hope. So as I said in my piece, Rory has won two tournaments this year. He's playing tremendous golf. His ability to bounce back is unbelievable. He, by all rights, should be the favorite, even above Scotty. And yet I will not take him. I simply won't do it until he can prove that he's going to have to win a major before I believe he can win a major, if that makes sense. Like Rory is, he's just so good. He's just such a good golfer who has never dropped off his level. But the fact that he has not won a major in 10 years while being at that elite level is just continues to be staggering, and the way he's found new ways to lose. So, yeah, in the past it would be like, well, okay, here he comes, shooting a 65 on Sunday to kind of briefly give us hope, but there's not really ever actual hope, right? He finishes fifth, never really had a chance. The minute he got close, he bogeyed. Pinehurst last year was – he had that thing won. That was the moment. It should have been the moment when it all broke through. It's the most devastating loss I've ever seen, I think, in person in golf. So he's got every ability to win. I just think with Augusta in particular, because for him, that would be winning the career Grand Slam, right? That would be, bigger than winning any other major, all of which would be big. Because of that, I think the pressure is so immense that it's just really, really tough. I just think something always happens there. I hope I'm wrong. I want to see Rory compete. I want to see him in the mix, but I can't get there spiritually, emotionally.
I am completely with you. I will say this. There's a couple things I was thinking about with Rory. One is, what do you think most people would guess his age is at this point? Like, if you just walked up to a person on the street and you asked them, like, hey, how old is Rory?
At least like 45, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? Because he's been in our lives forever. He's 35 years old. And yet, like, the pressure right now feels so immense. Like, oh my God, he has to get it done now before he's old and wild. It's like he's 35. So there is that component.
He could break our heart for 10 more years. Yeah.
That's kind of my second part of this is there. I got to admit that there is a small part of me that goes, I like having this story every year. And if he does it, it's gone forever, right? It's gone. We no longer have Rory at the Masters. So I'm rooting for two things to happen here is that, yes, he's around it. And yes, he starts out great. And yes, he's there on Sunday and that we have all the drama and we have all the eyeballs and the storyline, but also that he continues not to win so that we can keep doing this for the next 10 years.
You're not going to be welcome in Ireland or Northern Ireland ever again.
That's fine.
No, I totally agree. So it was funny because at Pinehurst, I was following him and I had negotiated with my friend. He was going to do Bryce and I was going to do Rory no matter what happened. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. I'm going to get to write the story of him winning. And he didn't win. And the story I wrote, I think, it's just, not to pat myself on the back, but it got a lot of buzz and a lot of traffic and a lot of praise. And people really liked it. And I was thinking after, and my friend actually said to me, like, you never would have had that kind of juice if he had won. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I wasn't rooting for him to lose, but the fact that he did lose was good for Shane Ryan. So I totally get your point. There's that sort of tension. It keeps us going, right? And it's like once that tension's resolved, well, that's great, and it's a great story that time, but you don't have it anymore. That's gone.
Are we overlooking Bryson?
So my thing with Bryson, I think what I wrote is that you can never rule out him getting on a heater at a course like Augusta, where length is rewarded, of course, and he's had some good showings there before, but he's not doing that well this year on LIV, and so unfortunately that's all we have to judge on, right? And it's tough to judge on that, but you would think if you're going to be elite and you want to be compared to the PGA Tour players, you at least have to be top five on LIV because there's some good players there, but there's also a lot of chaff. And the fact that he's, whatever he is, a little bit lower 20th or something, definitely cause for concern. I always feel like you've seen the same thing with Xander. The year after guys win a big major, there can be a letdown, and that may be happening to him right now. So he's not my first pick. I just saw a graphic that people are taking range practice, and Augusta keeps track of how many they take, how many shots they take, and it's like Scheffler took 60, Rory took 50, Bryson took 240, and the only guy who compared to him is Max Homa, who took 247, and Homa's absolutely in the worst, worst part of his career right now. He's struggling. So that to me is another bad sign that I think Bryson's really looking for it. Puncher's chance, but that's about it, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay. So the Scheffler of it all. I thought when he won the second time here that it was going to be okay. Not again, no one's ever going to be Tiger, right? It's not. But you love having the guy who everyone thinks is going to win when he's around it on Sunday and has that fear factor, right? When someone duffs it, you're like, oh, it's because Scheffler was with him and he was closing in. That's great for golf. That's great for sports in general, is feeling like there is a guy who is clutch. No back-to-back champion since Tiger in 02. And so do you actually believe if he was able to accomplish this three times in 4 years and be the first guy to go back-to-back since 02, that this actually would vaunt him into the territory that I thought was going to happen the last time he won.
Yeah. I think, you know, he's still far from Tiger territory, but he's pretty comfortably, I think, already in the best since Tiger territory. So yeah. Winning a third Masters in 4 years would get him closer. And then it would just be, okay, well, he's got to win a different major now, right? I mean, it sounds like you're getting greedy. Like, not good enough.
Yeah, that is. That's the greediest thing. Imagine saying that to him or asking that in the question. Like, do you feel more pressure to win just a different major? Like, you're only win the Masters. This is boring. Just
immediately after. Yeah. I guess what I meant by that was more like to be considered in Tiger caliber, right? To really be.
Yeah.
To really go into the ether. But, yeah, no, I mean, pretty good to be the best since Tiger. So, no, yeah, that would be – I think he's got a great chance. I mean, it really seemed like cutting his hand, fixing ravioli or whatever he was doing, actually hurt his, the beginning of his season a lot. But then in Houston we saw it almost seems like perfect timing. Houston, he came up and he had a chance to win at the end there. He finished one shot short. And, you know, Augusta's just one of those tournaments where it's a smaller field. You have a number of guys who make it because they're past champions or amateurs who don't have a realistic shot. And so you're really only competing against, God, like 50 players. I mean, and that might be generous even. So when you get a guy like Scotty, who's on form, obviously loves the course and has had a ton of success and is clutch, the odds become so much more in his favor than they would be at any other golf tournament. It doesn't mean he's going to win, of course. And for all the reasons you said, it's not easy to win back-to-back. And he's going to have a lot of people – really good players competing with him, but he just looks so strong right now, as always. And even, you know, the putting is the barometer. You know, when he's struggling putting, his putting's good this year. And it was just a matter of him catching up on ball striking, which it looks like he has. So to me, overwhelming favorite, you know, with a star, it's just tough to pick against the guy right now.
Well, part of what you mentioned has to do, like, with the smaller field is why we have this number. But it's like, yeah, the lowest ranked player to win this tournament since 2011. You want to guess who it was?
Oh, man. Well, it had to be Willett that year, right?
No, it wasn't. No, he was 11th. Bubba was 18th in 2012. And you wrote about 41 guys, right? And it's like you didn't write all 41 could win. But yeah, that is part of it when it comes to Scottie Scheffler. And this is even more complicated when it comes to like the top 20 guys in this tournament because of the live quotient and not really knowing where those guys stack up right now. But out of, if you're going player that is conclusively not in the top 20 right now, like taking out the live dudes who would kind of slot into those slots, who would you say is the most compelling to you in terms of like, you know what, this is a tournament for the best guys who are in the peaks of their career, but who's the dude where you're kind of circling them and being like, yeah, I'm paying real close attention to this guy. Because I actually do believe there is a shot for him to win.
Yeah, so outside the top 20, my guy is Akshay Bhatia. He's lefty, which is always rewarded there.
Yeah.
He's playing really well. He won a couple times last year. I just have a feeling about him. It's just one of those kind of vibe things where, you know, I could look like an idiot on Thursday when he shoots 79. But I really like him. I do think, and this is not pandering, I promise, but I do think Corey Connors, you know, he's finished top 10 three times, and he's just such a good ball striker. You know, I don't rate him very highly as a putter, but if he could have a great week putting, I think definitely he could compete. And I just kind of marked him, you know, if you're looking to bet on a guy who's going to make the top 10, I think Connors is a really good bet, and he's just outside that top 20. You know, other guys, I'm looking at the rankings now. Aaron Rye, another guy I identified. He's been playing really well lately. Like me, he wears two black gloves, so he's got a special place in my heart. And then just some, you know, a Justin Rose, Jason Day type guys who've been there before, who've had really high finishes and finished second before. I think they're always just a little bit dangerous. You know, you think of them as old and washed, but you know, Day's been playing really well. Rose finished second at Troon last year at the Open. So guys like that, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see them in the mix on Sunday.
I love the two black golf or the two black gloves take just because, like, that's what you're mostly looking for, right? Is like an avatar at this goal. You're like, hey, who's me? Who am I here?
Yeah, I don't know why he does it. I do it because I sweat way too much to have normal gloves. So I need rain gloves, but, you know, in 100 degree weather in the summer. So I don't think that's why he does it, but I appreciate it anyway for the rest of us.
Maybe he does. Conditions a factor for you in terms of the way that you're evaluating this tournament?
Not really, because I think, you know, it rains Monday, and I think if it kept raining, you'd say, oh, interesting, you know, maybe this could be a year for – maybe everything could be easier, and you'd get a guy that you wouldn't expect, like Tony Finau, to come and light it up. But I think it's going to be dry enough that, you know, the last 2 days have been dry, and by tomorrow I think it'll be normal Augusta. So I don't think you're going to have any, like, anomalous kind of results because of weird conditions.
Yeah, normal Augusta minus those huge pine trees that we're absolutely going to miss on the broadcast. Hey, Shane, it's always a pleasure. Again, the piece that's up on Golf Digest that I really think people should go read because it is excellent and you will laugh. I promise you will laugh. Your Vibes Only Guide, it's up on that site right now. And again, author of The Cup They Couldn't Lose. Thanks for making time, buddy. I always appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always fun. Thank you.
Yeah, take care, man. Shane Ryan, contributor for Golf Digest and, of course, author of that book. And yes, he's right. All of the, I hate saying it this way, but the negativity that I feel about golf right now, which is, I can't lie that the LIV thing soured me to a degree because I got excited for a rivalry. I got excited for the potential of genuine animosity between PGA golfers that I didn't think were the most compelling figures in sports. Okay. This is, they're not, it's not the most compelling to me. I need a little bit more at stake than who is going to be the richest guy. Right. So you want legacy stakes and you want personal stakes, and the stuff with Patrick Reed was super compelling, and all the quotes you're getting from Phil, it was great. And it felt like there was this real momentum behind it. Don't you remember how much you cared about wanting to see Full Swing? For those of you that care remotely about this stuff, I know I did. I couldn't wait for Full Swing. And now it's in its like third season, and I could not tell you a solitary thing that happened in it because I had no reason to watch. I was like, yeah, okay. Once Rory bent the knee and was like, yeah, this is fine. I'm not mad, and who cares? It was dead. So that rivalry component is gone from this thing. So I've been a little down on it. Like, it was hard to see Rom go. It really was. Rom, total household name, complete stud, decides to go over there, and it felt like a thinning of the PGA, but without any more reward of, oh, well, when we do get to see these guys, it's going to mean more. But come Thursday, when they actually start playing golf tomorrow, I'm going to love it, and I'm going to be completely compelled and enthralled and all these different things, and it's going to completely absorb almost all of my attention. Anyways, McDonald's Canada has just launched new smoky maple breakfast options. The smoky maple bacon and egg McMuffin, smoky maple sausage and egg McGriddle, and smoky maple chicken McMuffin. To celebrate, we're giving away $250 in McDonald's gift cards. To enter, listen for the code word, then text the code word to 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply. Today's code word is breakfast. Text breakfast to 590-590 right now for your chance to win. We're giving away another gift card tomorrow, so be sure to tune in then. All right. Please subscribe to this podcast. Follow it on Spotify and Apple. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. We'll have a quick break. We'll come back, hit what we must, including the firing of yet another championship-winning head coach in the NBA.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Christian trying to make it romantic to close the show today. Christian, Armin, what did we miss?
Michael Malone and Calvin Booth were fired by the Denver Nuggets. It is the latest firing in NBA history, tied for the latest with Hubie Brown being let go in 1980. Mm. A lot of things were said afterwards of the news. One clip that went viral that kind of fell under the radar from a few weeks ago after losing to the Trailblazers. Coach Mike Malone had some strong comments about his players. Let's play some of it.
I think each guy's got to look themselves in the mirror and start coming to each respective game with the proper mindset and have some pride. I didn't think we played with any pride tonight.
How do you feel like they took that?
I really care. It's not my job to evaluate how they take things. My job is to be honest, and sometimes brutally honest. And tonight, it was a brutally honest message. And the guys that are full of shit won't hear it. You know, they'll say coach is tripping. And the guys that maybe do really care will because they don't want, they're not going to go back and watch their minutes because nobody watches their minutes. Nobody watches film. So we'll have to show them the film. And I said, if somebody disagrees with me, please speak up. And not, nobody said a word. So, again, I'm not really concerned with how they took that message. My thing is being honest with how we just played.
Also, I want to add in what the owner said right after the firing. He spoke to Altitude TV, and he said, having observed that group over a period of time, there were certain trends that were very worrisome to me at different points, but they could get masked by a few wins here and there. Message to the team now, play hard and have fun. Bunk?
Yeah.
You think the Nuggets are better off or worse off heading into the playoffs, which the regular season ends in 5 days?
Well, it's obviously worse off. There's just no, there's no sugarcoating this. Even when you mention how late this firing is, and how it's like, oh, it's the latest since Hubie Brown. There's a reason why teams don't fire their head coaches this close to the postseason. It's because you're getting ready for the postseason. The Hubie Brown stat that you reference, do you think that Hubie Brown's team was in the playoffs that year? No. It was a 31-win Atlanta Hawks team. So, yeah, you can fire that coach, because when you fire the coach, you're signaling to the group, yeah, we're done. We're done, fellas. We're screwed. We suck. The Memphis thing was shocking, and Memphis isn't Denver, okay? They've won a championship. This is getting very odd to me in terms of what the lifespan is of coaches who win championships and what their runway is here. Because I didn't have Malone on my radar. Yeah, I'm a big Nuggets fan. I like Denver. I like watching their games. I think that it's kind of important to be able to clock what Nikola Jokic is doing, because he's the best player in the NBA, and it's by a pretty healthy margin. I do think that Shea is going to win MVP, and I go back and forth on it. I'll be honest, from time to time. I know to this audience, that's probably not going to be well received, but yeah, he's the best player in the NBA, and Shea is having a brilliant season, a unbelievable season, a MVP deserving season, one that in so many years would be just like an automatic, but he's up against Jokic, who's doing what he's doing. And when he's off the floor, they are just a bumbling complete mess. They are terrible. There's an awful basketball team. So I look at them and say, Calvin Booth getting fired is a bit of a no-brainer. Doing it now feels, again, desperate, feels strange, but this is a team that's not paying into the second apron despite having Nikola Jokic, which is just like beyond unacceptable, beyond unacceptable. And I don't know how much of that is ownership versus what Calvin Booth is doing, but I don't think Calvin Booth is a very good GM. And to me, despite winning the championship, it's like, yeah, look at the roster, look what they've developed, look at some of the lack of activity they've had surrounding Jokic with a proper basketball team. And yeah, I don't think that there's been a move since the Aaron Gordon trade that I've really liked for this team. So Booth going, less surprising. The fact that these two guys have had real animosity towards one another, that they have not gotten along, that there were reportedly factions between Malone and between Booth, that's troubling stuff for an organization. And it seems like they just want to be like, yeah, we're removing all of that from the equation. But no, this is not a good thing. But yeah, this is now 4 of 6 championship coaches since 2019 are fired now, with Malone, Bud, Vogel, and Nurse. And some of those were, I think, a little bit more obvious. Bud, in hindsight, I don't know. Especially the way that it was handled immediately afterwards with the Milwaukee Bucks. Vogel, kind of an obvious one. Yeah, it's like, whatever, out of that group. Nick Nurse, we all thought was going to be the coach of the Raptors forever. And it got sour really, really quick. So it devolved to a point where you kind of understood it more, especially when Nick Nurse was holding media conferences and basically insinuating that he didn't want to be here anymore. But Mike Malone, that's the franchise's first championship. Who thinks Mike Malone isn't a great coach? You think that they're going to, you know, do better than Mike Malone? Part of the Mike Malone experience was making fun of Sacramento for giving up on this guy because he is one of the better coaches in the NBA. And so to see this happen right now, it's sad. It's sad to think about wasted seasons for the Denver Nuggets, who employ the best player on planet Earth. Like, by, again, to me, a fairly significant margin. There is nobody like Jokic. I'm begging you, even if you don't like basketball, give it a shot watching this guy. Just give it a chance. Wait up tonight. They play Sacramento. I'm going to watch tonight's game because I think it's extremely compelling seeing what kind of an effort they give against a Sacramento Kings team that just clinched a play-in spot. Congrats to Sacramento, by the way, and congrats to the Phoenix Suns, who are not going to be in the play-in game despite having Kevin Durant and Devin Booker, and traded away every draft pick in the franchise's next 20 years to be able to get Bradley Beal. You couldn't beat a Sacramento team that traded away De'Aaron Fox this season and did the Bulls run it back of Zach LaVine and DeMar DeRozan. Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff there. But yeah.
So, Bunk, throughout the season, you know, we've had the discussion and you've said the Nuggets are would be the team you'd have to pick to make the finals, to make the run in the West. Do you feel?
Oh, no, it hasn't been that way in a while, man. You haven't checked in on me this in a while then, because no, I actually,
maybe
from the outset of the season.
Maybe a month or so when you said it last.
This is wrong. This is actually wrong, because I started this year watching these teams, watching Milwaukee and Denver from the outset. It was wild to me what a mirror they were of each other in terms of two teams that had won championships. And now the mirroring continues because Denver has fired their coach and Milwaukee fired theirs. That was 2021 when they fired Bud. It's been two. Yeah. For Adrian Griffin and then obviously Doc. So at the very beginning of the season, I looked at this and I said, ooh, this is troublesome. I really don't like the team that's around Denver. And I didn't like where Jamal Murray was at. And I felt more confident in them as the year went on because Jamal Murray started to look like himself. And I thought, okay, if Jamal Murray's Jamal Murray again, then everything's fine. But now he's hurt. And they're talking about him as though they don't think this is it's pretty clear this isn't a load management situation where they're going, no, we're resting Jamal Murray. We want to make sure he's right for the postseason, especially considering this group could easily drop to seventh. That it's like 4-7. Those are very realistic possibilities for the Denver Nuggets, and they do not want to be in that seven seed, obviously, for a billion different reasons. But yeah, the play-in being primary in all of them. But either way, Jamal Murray, I'm not sure what the future holds for him. I'm not sure if he's playing in the postseason anymore. I just genuinely don't know. I don't think anybody knows other than the Denver Nuggets and Jamal Murray himself. So that's a huge trouble sign, because outside of him, one of the problems with this Denver team is they have not developed guys. They have not figured out what it is supposed to look like around Nikola Jokic, a player who elevates everyone around him. They still haven't been able to figure out, hey, can we get a deeper bench? Hey, can we figure out if we're going to have some good perimeter defenders, if we're going to be a good three-point shooter? Like, they have zero identity other than Jokic. Just Jokic, Jokic, Jokic. No, I don't think that they're making the championship. I would be blown away, shocked if they made it. I like Oklahoma City the most by far. I don't know how anyone could kind of say otherwise. But Denver, now with this and with the Jamal Murray stuff, I think that if you're looking at groups to make a title run of the Western Conference, you have at least four teams out of them. Because I would say Oklahoma City, Golden State, the Lakers, shockingly, but still, I'm not writing off the Lakers in terms of having Luka and LeBron and being able to get hot. I don't think that they will, but I would have them ahead of Denver right now, and the Timberwolves. And I might even be missing somebody, but that's like thinking about this right now. All those groups conclusively to me, as of this moment, should have a better shot than Denver, and certainly are going to have a better shot than Denver if Denver ends up finishing seventh. So no, it's a disaster. It's awful. And yeah, congrats to Denver on getting your championship. But I will tell you this. It's one thing when you have Kawhi Leonard on a rental season that he wins you a championship and then he decides to go to Los Angeles where he wanted to be all along. And the feeling like, yeah, you know what? We got one. Awesome. And we were a tortured franchise without a championship. As a Seahawks fan, and this is the only group that I can talk about this from this perspective, kind of the 2015-2016 Blue Jays, just in the sense of like the feeling of that you missed on something, but whatever. More so the Seahawks thing. Seahawks won a Super Bowl, and some of my friends that haven't won, or I got buddies who are Vikings fans, whatever, and they go, oh man, I would just kill for one. You know, I just want one. I just want one. And I agree. Like, you do just want one. Bills fans would kill to be in my position. But it's not the worst because you win a championship, but it really does suck when you have a group that should win multiple titles and you don't. And for Denver to get one title, but have the best player on planet Earth. And if that is what the destiny of this team is, you'll always celebrate that championship. It'll always be a happy memory, but it will come with the thought of, God, it really should have been more. The runway should have been longer. So, yeah, I hate this for Denver. It's a bad sign. It's bad vibes all around. And, yeah, I'm not sure what the future holds for this team. I guess, like, to my point, the general managing, I don't think could get much worse than what it's been the last couple of seasons. But I would hate to see Nikola Jokic's career go this way, where it's like Giannis Antetokounmpo, where I squint and go, man, the only way I think you can win is if you leave.
Maybe he's got to leave.
No, I don't think he will.
Raptors are fourth in the favorites to be his next team. I'm just saying on a sports book. But, Bunk, while we're on Denver, I just want to quickly ask you, too. Mm-hmm. Carmelo was celebrated last night. He got the nod to go to the Hall of Fame. He got a standing ovation at Madison Square Garden. And Melo was saying that he would love if his jersey was hanging in both Denver and in New York. Which one of those two teams do you think of him more with? And do you think he'll get his jersey retired in both?
He's a Knick.
Knick first, Knick. Eh? Yeah.
Well, he's from Brooklyn, and he had the coming home video, and yeah, he's a Knick. It's just
he obviously never left the first round with the Knicks. He at least went to a conference finals with Denver.
Yeah, I got to tell you, the conference finals thing, was Melo a very cool Denver Nuggets player? Yes, absolutely. Do I think about that? Everyone can picture that jersey in their mind's eye. A lot of people had that jersey. It was very, 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 very popular for people my age. Carmelo's a great player. I think that he's weirdly underrated to history now, that his career went from like, hey, how great is this guy, to being in LeBron's shadow and then never ended up winning and was this like one of the best scorers I've ever seen. And then Durant came and kind of took that mantle from him of like the big guy that you would want to score late in a basketball game, blah, 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 blah. But no, this is the same thing as Vince, where I don't like it. If the Knicks retired his jersey, I would say fine. But no, you ask for a trade, you want out, and you didn't win anything. Like, what is the bar for this stuff? And I'm sure he will go up, but yeah, if I had my druthers, it'd be an absolute no-brainer to not put him up there. Anyways, we'll see you tomorrow, loaded with guests. We've got three of them. We'll see you then.